At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The defining characteristic of the early days of this crisis was speed, how the bailout story was changing practically by the hour. Amazing for what was, in essence, a political story. Well, Wall Street moves plenty quickly, too, you know, and what we're seeing now is a head snap toward the next phase of this whole thing, falling corporate profits helping to drive a down economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 22nd of October. Good to have you here. You know, I said a couple of weeks ago that this is not a stock story, and really, it still isn't. But as often happens, the Dow is a pretty good barometer of what the actual story is. In this case, corporate profits. We'll give you those headlines, and we'll look at whether companies can get the loans they need to recover some of those profits. And consider that dollar bill in your pocket. Might not look much different, but it's worth a whole lot more now than it was a month ago. We told you yesterday regional banks are making less money. Today, the ripples spread. Drug companies, telecommunications, and transportation, everybody reported lower profits. The Federal Reserve, meanwhile, is fixated on interest rates. While short-term credit markets do seem to be easing, that is, it's looking like credit's easier to get, the Fed is in the middle of a tug-of-war over who's going to control interest rates on those loans that banks make to each other. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Fed is a control freak. Right now, banks will only make overnight loans to each other. So many are willing to make quickie loans, the interest rate has fallen below 1%, way below the Fed's target. Interest rates on 1 to 6 month loans are a lot higher. That's because banks still aren't lending to each other long term. So the Fed is raising the interest rate it pays banks to stash excess money in Fed accounts. That should suck up some of the cash now going into overnight loans. Ken Kuttner is a former Fed economist who now teaches economics at Williams College.
The Fed is really trying to strike a balance between making sure there's sufficient liquidity to get the system unfrozen, while at the same time maintaining control of the interest rate.
So now the Fed will take those cash deposits from banks and increase the number of long-term loans it makes to banks.
So the Fed is inserting itself into the market and being a much larger provider of credit than usual.
Brian Sack is with Macroeconomic Advisors. He's also a former Fed economist. He says the Fed hopes banks will follow its lead and start giving each other those long-term loans. Now, I know you're wondering why on earth you should care if banks lend to each other. Listen to Sack explain how we fit into the banking food chain.
What the Fed is trying to do is fix the markets through which the banks, fund themselves in hope that they will then be willing to go out and start lending to firms and to households.
But Sachs says that's not likely to happen until the middle of next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Until recently, struggling American companies could count on making up some of those lost profits by doing business overseas, a benefit of the weak dollar. Well, thanks to the credit crisis, the value of the greenback has now shifted dramatically. The good news is that our dollars will buy more these days, but the bad news is that their dollars, whatever you're going to call them, are going to buy less. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
As recently as July, a British pound would set you back more than $2. Today, it fell to its lowest level in 5 years, around $1.63. The 15-nation euro is also slumping. Shouldn't we be celebrating that our greenbacks are now worth more? They'll buy more oil and other vital commodities, all things being equal. But these days, all things are not equal.
A rising dollar in these economic conditions and the current market turmoil is not a good thing for the U.S. economy.
That's Ashraf Laidi, who tracks currencies for CMC Markets. He points out our economy is tanking too, and now it won't be as easy to sell our goods and services overseas. And the money American companies do make in currencies abroad won't be worth as much. Still, it could be worse. Robert Blake heads foreign exchange strategy at State Street Global.
The dollar is still a lot lower against, in particular, European currencies than it was, say, at the start of 2002. So while we've regained lost ground in some respects relative to the past year or two, the dollar's levels currently are not that abnormal or out of line.
Americans might normally take comfort in seeing the value of the dollar grow, but at Roth Capital Partners, Donald Strossheim says at this point, it's a mixed blessing.
I would much rather have the currency be strong because U.S. growth was vibrant and our economy was competitive. Now the currency is strong because while we've been hurt by the credit crisis, other countries have been hurt even more.
Strossheim says that's not the right reason to be happy about a rising currency. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Wall Street firms handed out more than $30 billion in bonuses alone last year. A big chunk of that went to the very people who presided over the near collapse of the financial system. The bailout plan, though, has put executive compensation under a new kind of high-power microscope, with Congress and now the Securities and Exchange Commission saying U.S. companies just can't pay people as much anymore. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Anger over executive pay has become so widespread that both presidential candidates are using it to rally voters.
We can't have taxpayers footing the bill for bloated golden parachutes.
Something's wrong when CEOs are making more in 10 minutes than ordinary workers are making in an entire year.
Wall Street's taxpayer-funded bailout has made the matter personal, says Charles Elson, director of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware.
The folks in the banking industry were amongst the highest paid people around. They justified the amount, saying that they were smarter than anybody else in the room. And you suddenly began to say, were they worth it? And the answer was no.
Elson says the combination of renewed regulatory pressure and public outrage will shame financial companies into reducing executive salaries, bonuses, and golden parachutes. He says that will bleed over into other industries. Sarah Anderson, executive pay analyst at the Institute for Policy Studies, doesn't buy it.
We've been waiting for years to see the shame factor have an impact on executives. It's just not going to happen.
Anderson says the government is mostly leaving the issue up to the companies, and relying on those firms to police themselves won't work.
Congress missed a huge opportunity by not putting strict limits on executive pay in the bailout bill. They leave those decisions up to the Treasury Secretary.
Germany, Sweden, the UK, and Australia are also looking into restricting CEO pay at financial firms getting money from the government. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Not much else to say at this point other than all 30 Dow components were down today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo announced a deal with AIG today. AIG, you might remember, is the insurance company that we the people officially own 79.9% of now, thanks to a federal bailout. Anyway, it's going to withhold tens of millions of dollars in executive bonuses and compensation until Cuomo's investigation into its collapse is finished. Most of those executives aren't with the company anymore, having been canned by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson when he ponied up the $85 billion that has kept AIG going.
The boss will see you now.
And so today on Conversations from the Corner Office, the new guy who's got to clean up the mess at AIG, CEO Ed Liddy. Not only does he have to turn the company around, but he's got to deal with some really bad press, too. When we spoke yesterday, I asked him about that. Obviously, it's been a tough month or two for this company. The last 2 weeks, though, have been especially rough. You've gotten a lot of press for some of the spending that you guys have done on vacation trips and junkets, and Congress has been questioning very seriously how you spend your money. Do you understand why people are upset about that?
Oh, we understand it perfectly why people are upset, and you know we're embarrassed by it, and I apologize to people for it. Let me say this, and it's not an excuse. This is a large place. We do business in over 130 countries. We have over $100 billion in revenue. You know, think of the battleship. You simply can't bring it to a halt quickly enough. Now, we have stopped all the kinds of activities that you just mentioned. We've absolutely shut them down. It was one of the first things that we did, in fact, when I arrived here. So I think we're in pretty good shape. Most of the activity that's being focused on, you know, they're not activities that involved AIG employees. They are sales conferences for independent agents who have sold our products. We've stopped those kinds of activities, but it takes a while to do all that.
You've been at AIG now, sir, about a month. I'd love your take on what you think went wrong to get you this job.
I have been here about a month. It seems like it's been multiple years. I think that we, AIG, kind of branched out into some projects that were outside our core. They were more financial products and less insurance products. They are riskier products. We went far too large in them. It's really brought us to our knees. That business has been shut down. It will not be a part of us going forward. But we've had to put a lot of collateral out for these various products, and that's a check. We have to keep writing checks, and we simply ran out of cash. That's why we needed the help of the federal government to continue in business today.
And you did get that help. It was about $85 billion, that first loan. According to my research, you've drawn down about $70 billion worth of that. How are you going to pay it back?
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to drop back to what has historically been our core, property casualty operations in the United States and what's known as foreign general in Europe. These are big businesses. They generate about $40 billion a year in revenue. But all of the other assets that we have, except for our foreign life business, we'd like to try to maintain a majority stake in that. But everything else that we have, we're going to sell to pay down that loan.
Are you worried at all about selling into a down economy?
You know, I am. I think that's partially offset by the fact that some of these assets, you know, you couldn't recreate them. You couldn't build them from scratch if you wanted to. So I think that they really are. They fit the definition of a premier asset. I would much rather be selling these assets in a more stable environment, you know, where the capital markets were a little bit more fluid and a little bit more solid. But you have the market that you have, so you have to deal with it.
How close are you now to making that first asset sale?
You know, we just announced which assets were for sale 2 weeks ago, so that process takes a while. We know the marketplace is very keenly interested in it. So what we're doing, we want to move that process expeditiously, but we don't want to do it so quickly that we lose any value.
Henry Paulson, a guy you've known for a while, I imagine, calls you 6 or 8 weeks ago and says, listen, Ed, have I got a deal for you. We need you to run AIG. What was your first thought?
My first thought was I was very happy doing what I was doing. I had retired from Allstate. I was involved with a very fine private equity firm by the name of Clayton Dubilier. But, you know, when you get a couple of calls like that and people say, can you help us? The country needs it. The financial system needs it. You have two choices. You can either stay on the sidelines and be an interested observer, or you can try to get in the game and help. I chose to do the latter.
You are obviously the CEO of this company, but it's sort of changing times. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York has offices in your building, and I understand you consult with the Fed fairly regularly. What are those conversations like?
You know, it's a very good relationship. Anytime somebody is on the on the hook to loan you $85 billion, guess what? They want to know what's going on. So we are very transparent with the Fed. We share with them kind of where we are on our asset dispositions, on our strategy. We share all that with the Federal Reserve.
Step back for me for a minute, Mr. Liddy, and look at this larger economic crisis we're having. What's the lesson from the failure of AIG?
I think there's no one silver bullet that would explain that, Kai. I think it's a variety of things. It's too much leverage in the system. It's probably not the right kinds of regulation around the mortgage markets. It might be, you know, were the rating agencies proficient enough at rating some of these things? I just think it's a whole host of things. But I would say with respect to AIG, when a company moves away from its core, the thing which it really knows well, and begins to branch out into something else, it usually spells trouble. And in AIG's case, that's exactly what happened.
Ed Liddy, the CEO of AIG. Mr. Liddy, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial sliced off 5 2/3% today, 514 points to close at 8,519. The NASDAQ gave back 4 3/4%, 80 points, ended at 1615. The S&P 500 slid 6 1/10%, 58 points, closed at 896. Poor corporate profits, as I mentioned, were to blame one more time. Shares in Boeing fell 7.5% after the plane maker reported a 38% drop in third quarter profits. Pharmaceutical giant Merck shed more than 6.5%. And Wachovia, which is being bought by Wells Fargo, fell 6 1/4% today. That after posting one of the biggest quarterly losses in banking history. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.6%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management. Online at shrm.org. Want to know what our hosts and reporters are experiencing as they cover America's financial crisis? You'll find their stories, insights, and observations at our website. Head to Marketplace.org and look for Marketplace's off-air staff blog.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Thursday. The Peterson Institute for International Economics releases a study on the future of international financial regulation. The New York City Council votes on a bill that would allow the mayor and city council members to run for third terms. And on this day, 7 years ago, Apple introduced the world to the iPod. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Congress is in full oversight mode this week. There are hearings on everything from financial reforms to how this whole thing happened in the first place to what's going on with the bailout package. Some banks are thinking about using their share of the bailout money to buy other banks. Bigger is usually better in the financial world, except, says commentator Robert Reich, for what that means to the rest of us.
According to Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, the biggest Wall Street banks now getting money from the government are just too big to fail. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke uses a different euphemism. He calls them systemically critical. The point is that if any one of them goes down, it could take the whole financial system with it. So we taxpayers have to keep them up. We're hearing the same argument elsewhere in Washington for saving General Motors. It's just too big to fail. So Congress is considering a bailout that would keep GM afloat and sweeten a merger between GM and Chrysler. Pardon me for asking, but if a company is too big to fail, maybe, just maybe, it's too big, period. We used to have public policies to prevent companies from getting too big. Does anyone remember antitrust laws? Somewhere along the line, policymakers decided that antitrust would only be used where there was evidence a company had so much market power it could keep prices higher than otherwise. We seem to have forgotten that the original purpose of antitrust law was also to prevent companies from becoming too powerful. Too powerful in that so many other companies depended on them, so many jobs turned on them, and so many consumers or investors or depositors needed them that the economy as a whole would be endangered if they failed. Too powerful in that they could wield inordinate political influence of a sort that might gain them extra favors from Washington. Maybe the biggest irony today is that Washington policymakers who are funneling taxpayer dollars to these too-big-to-fail companies are simultaneously pushing them to consolidate into even bigger companies. They prodded Bank of America to take over Merrill Lynch and Countrywide. J.P. Morgan to acquire Washington Mutual and Bear Stearns. And now they're urging General Motors to absorb Chrysler. So we're ending up with even bigger giants, with even more power over the economy and politics, subsidized by taxpayers, and guaranteed never to fail because they're just too big.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Supercapitalism. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Shares of Apple bounced about 7% today. That was on the strength of a better-than-expected profit report after the bell yesterday. But estimates for the coming quarter didn't quite meet Wall Street's expectations. The slowing economy is probably to blame for most of that pessimism. But a new toy out today from another well-known technology company could wind up being a factor as well. If you don't mind shelling out $179 and signing up for a 2-year contract, you can get yourself the very first Google phone. Made by T-Mobile, actually, but the G1's got Google on the inside. Kevin Pereira from G4 Television always gets the fun toys before anybody else. Kevin, good to see you again.
Always a pleasure to see you,
sir. All right, so here it is, the G1.
Hold on, let me... I lost my falsetto playing Rock Band last night, but I want to hand you the shiny, pretty packaging. This is the T-Mobile G1. It's the first Google Android-powered phone. Did I completely lose everybody there?
Yeah, explain what
Fantastic.
That means.
Fantastic. All right, so there's an important distinction to make about this, quote, just another cell phone. Mm-hmm. This is the G1. It's a T-Mobile cell phone, meaning that's the only carrier you can get it on. Slide it open, full QWERTY keyboard, touchscreen, yada, yada, great, grand, wonderful, we get it. We've seen 1,000 in one of these phones.
However, comma.
The difference is that it is powered by Google Android. And Android is the open source mobile platform created by that little company that we all know and love, Google.
Uh-huh.
And this is their big competitor to Apple's iPhone, Windows Mobile, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, so let's get to the nuts and bolts here.
Sure.
First of all, let me play with it. Give it over
here. Absolutely. Here you go.
Oh, my.
That phone, in fact, with all the power of this phone, we're talking YouTube videos and a powerful web browser, the App Store. I mean, this thing has a barcode scanner on it. I could point it to a barcode on a store shelf. It will scan it, connect to the internet, and tell me if I can get a better price elsewhere.
No way.
But with that said, and all the instant messaging and video gaming, and I didn't even mention the trackball yet, this is my favorite application.
Which is?
Hold that to the mic, and you'll see it's a nice screen filled with some fur. And go ahead and give your phone a little pet. Go ahead and just give it a little pet.
Oh, this is freaky. It's actually buzzing in my hands.
It's the biggest waste of memory I've ever seen in my life, and yet you can't stop.
All right, so let's talk functionality.
Yeah, let's talk it. 3G phone with Wi-Fi as well, just like the old iPhone. You can have up to 16 gigs of memory, and you can swap that memory in and out of the phone. The phone itself feels good in the hand. It's a little bit thicker than the iPhone all around, but the big thing here, of course, is Android.
Android being the operating system, let's go through that one more time. It is open source. It is developer-friendly. What does that mean for people who are going to go out and shell out the, what is it, $179 plus a 2-year contract for this phone?
Yeah. You know, to the average Joe, to Joe the plumber, he's not going to know that it's Android. He's going to have no idea what the operating system is. He's going to know that the touchscreen works incredibly well, that it's responsive, that it operates flawlessly. He's going to know that in 3 weeks' time, which is how long we've been playing around with this thing, the phone has not crashed once. My iPhone crashed 3 times on the way to work this morning, and that was me just trying to take a photo or text while driving like everybody else. And again, when we talk open source versus a closed operating system, it's the difference between Linux and Mac. It's the difference between Windows and Mac, meaning that anybody can develop for the Android. Anybody can get their application onto the marketplace.
Yeah, you are a separate case because this is kind of your gig. What about people looking to conserve disposable income in a down economy? How's that affecting the whole mobile market, and is this necessarily the brightest time for T-Mobile and Google to be doing this?
Right. In terms of the financial crisis that we're all in right now, I see that affecting more of the ringtone seller, the wallpaper maker, or the application developer, and not so much the hand set manufacturers. People like new phones. They want the new features. This phone out of the box is great. I think that, you know, people used to justify purchasing a silly little application with the saying that, oh, it's just the price of a cup of coffee.
Right.
And I think the tonality of that statement changes in these times, and they go, hey, that's the price of a cup of coffee. You know, I'm not getting that silly little bubble shooter game, and I'm not paying $3 to have my to-do list on my phone. So that's where the crunch is really going to hit.
Kevin Pereira works at G4 Television, attack of the show. Today it was the G1 here, which is the Android-powered T-Mobile phone. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Kai, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
So, who do you like in the first game of the World Series tonight? The Tampa Bay Rays, baseball's Cinderella team, the worst record in all of baseball last year, now playing for all the marbles. Or are you, for some reason, a Philadelphia Phillies fan? They have been to the series before, but not in a long time, and they haven't won it in almost 30 years. There's all the usual inside baseball talk about pitching matchups and batting averages and on-base percentages and how all that's going to change the game. But as Marketplace's Nancy Fargali reports, there may be another game changer in the offing, not for the series this year, but coming some season soon with the crack of the bat.
It's not the play Major League Baseball wants you to see.
Here again, watch where the barrel of this bat goes.
That right thick part of the bat flew over the pitcher's mound. The Red Sox pitcher, John Lester, ducked out of the way.
Oftentimes you watch the ball, you don't see the bat coming, but look at him.
Those shattered bats are usually made from maple wood. Roughly 60% of players use maple bats. University of Chicago professor Alan Sanderson says a maple bat isn't as heavy as bats made of ash.
Lighter bat weight means greater bat speed, and so that increases the velocity of a batted ball or gives the batter a fraction of a second to decide where to swing or not. You know, if you can hit 10 points higher on your batting average, that may mean $1 million to you.
But maple bats carry risks like exploding into sharp pieces. Major League Baseball has collected more than 1,700 broken bats from July to September. This season, a chunk of maple hit a coach in the face. Another fragment shattered a fan's jaw. At a recent Dodgers game, Judy Ann Regan watched batting practice from her field-level seats. She's seen bats snap into pieces, but she's not in favor of one suggestion being batted around, extending a net around the first level of seats.
And when I come to a ballpark, is to get that outdoor feeling and see like you're part of the field. You don't want to look at a net like you're in prison.
More than 30 companies are licensed to produce maple bats for the major leagues, but there isn't a uniform standard for wood quality. So companies can compete by selling cheaper bats, and that means using cheaper wood. Major League Baseball formed a safety and health committee to study the manufacturing of maple bats.
It turns a pro bat in about 15 seconds. It's totally computerized and is 100% accurate on all the specs of the bat.
Chuck Shoup stands in the factory of Louisville Slugger. It supplies 80,000 bats a year to Major League Baseball. About half the bats are maple.
When you see a maple bat break, usually it's the one that does go in several pieces, and that is an issue, there's no doubt. That does not necessarily mean it's a bad piece of wood. That's just the way maple fails.
He says he welcomes Major League Baseball's inquiries. He's in favor of industry standards.
The bat integrity starts with that piece of wood, but I think they are looking at the right aspects of it, and I think at some point they might come up with some standards on, you know, how you process the wood, those type of things that probably have never been looked at in the past.
But tonight, fans will be more focused on how players use their bats. I'm Nancy Fergali for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes to send you on your way. Crude oil dropped another $5.43 today, $66.75 a barrel at the close in New York. I mention that because I got an email from a friend in Vermont earlier. She said she woke up to driving snow outside her window this morning. Probably lovely to look at. Not so great to live in, especially if you use oil for heat and if you signed contracts to fill up the tank in your basement back when oil was $147 a barrel. A lot of consumers up in the Northeast did exactly that, maybe because forecasts were for $200 a barrel back then. In some parts of New England, home heating oil prices today are 25% lower than when those contracts were signed, and there's really nothing to be done about it. And just to really brighten up your day, the government agency that backed private pensions is getting squeezed. According to a House committee today, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation lost $3.1 billion in the stock market over the past 11 months. No word yet on a bailout plan from Henry Paulson. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 514 points, 5 2/3%. The NASDAQ lost 80 points, 4 3/4%. The S&P 500 dropped 58 points. That's 6.1%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, where does all that bailout cash come from?
How do we make up the shortfall of like around $700 billion or so we know at this point?
Well, that's coming from the Fed's magic ATM machine.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Please join us for that explainer tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.